You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, taking you around the National League East for MLB.com Extras. We have to start by talking about the big series between the Mets and the Nationals. Let's start with the Mets and MLB.com Mets reporter Anthony DiComo. Big series at Citi Field this week. Mets-Nationals, finally, it seemed like this series has there's been enough buildup just because these teams hadn't faced each other yet. Now we're in mid-May, but obviously a great start for the Mets on Tuesday night. Noah Syndergaard out-dueling Max Scherzer on the hill. Back to that thought, though, about it taking so long for these two teams to play, you think that ended up being a good thing or a bad thing, the way the schedule worked out, that it's mid-May, teams that are going to play each other 18 times are finally meeting up for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, you could look at it both ways. I think it's certainly a good thing in terms of drama because, like you said, there was a bit of a build-up to this series that we wouldn't necessarily have had if it took place on April 15th. Ideally, you know, I think you'd like to spread it out a little more because teams change over the course of a summer, and if you really want a true representation of which is the better team, of which team's performing better over 162 games from April through late September into October, you know, ideally you would spread it out a little bit more and have these teams play at different intervals. Maybe one team that is doing well in April is not doing so well in June. So it's nice to get that sort of diversity of the calendar in there. But it is what it is. They're going to play each other 19 times, as the Mets will, every NL East division opponent. And it's going to happen one way or the other. So for it to happen now in mid-May, getting on late May, it's an interesting time because I think the Mets are standings-wise, record-wise, right where a lot of people thought they would be. I think the Nationals are probably doing a little bit better than most people thought they would be. But these are the two teams that everyone was looking at in the division, the two teams that everyone knew would probably be there at the end or at least close to the end. And frankly, when we look up again in September, regardless of what happens in these three games this week, you know, I think you're still going to be looking at these two teams fighting it out. I think they'll both be in it until the end. So it's going to be interesting to get that first taste this week. Getting that first taste this week, it's going to be interesting to get that second taste next week down in D.C. But like I said, this is going to be a season-long back and forth, and we'll see who ends up on top.
And Syndergaard ended up on top against Scherzer in the opener. Both pitchers, though, this one pretty much lived up to the hype from a pitching standpoint. Both guys were dominant. Both guys had the 10 strikeouts. Syndergaard lasted a little longer. And the Mets were able to do to Scherzer what teams have done to him this season, and that is capitalize on his mistakes. As good as he's allowed the long ball, and that's what the Mets did, a couple of solo shots, and that's all it took with Syndergaard on the hill. Is there an attitude there or an approach to Scherzer that the Mets had that, I know you're not swinging for home runs, but to know that this guy has made some mistakes this season, we need to make the most of them when they happen?
No, I'd actually disagree with you. I'd say the Mets are swinging.
They are swinging.
Runs.
All right, sure.
And that's not unique to Max Scherzer. That's not because he gives up a lot of them, relatively speaking. It's because that's the way this offense is built. That's how they're going to attack every pitcher. I think it's pretty clear now that their offense is going to live and die by the long ball. And you know, I say that with a grain of salt because people hear that and they act like it's a bad thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. Home runs are great. It's the best type of hit you can get. So a team that's hitting a lot of them is generally going to do very, very well, and the Mets are hitting a ton of homers. Now, of course, there is a downside. It means your offense is going to come in bunches a little bit. It means when you face a guy like Max Scherzer, you're not necessarily built to have the ability to get an infield hit and move the guy along, steal a base, hit and run, get a sacrifice fly and score that way. You're more going to sit back and you're going to wait for those two solo homers. And if you get them and your pitching holds up, you'll probably win. If you don't get them, you'll probably lose. So people take that and they look at it all the time in a negative context. But for me, whether you're facing Max Scherzer or Jose Fernandez or anyone really in the league, you know, if you have the ability to hit home runs, a lot of home runs on a regular basis, you have a pretty good offense. And the Mets have that ability. They have a pretty good offense. You saw it. They only scored two runs off Max Scherzer. That was all they needed. But that ability to take advantage of, not take advantage of Max Scherzer's weakness, but just to exploit their own strengths, hit home runs, that's going to serve them well all season long.
It was Daniel Murphy's return, obviously, to Citi Field, and the fans did a nice job. I mean, this is a guy that carried the Mets to the World Series, and clearly the fans did not forget that when he went to D.C. They did the little video tribute before the game. That's fine, but I think you really learn how the fans feel when the guy comes up to the plate for the first time, and a nice standing ovation from Murphy, and a nice moment, I think, even though he went to the rival to show appreciation for what a guy did a year ago.
Yeah, and you know what? You know what's interesting is if Daniel Murphy hadn't had the postseason he had, you'd still be looking at a player that served this franchise really, really well for eight seasons, who was here, through the bad times, who was a consistent good performer through the bad times, and so on and so forth. But if he hadn't done what he did in October, I don't think he would have sniffed the type of ovation, the type of reaction he got last night from the fans. They're just really appreciative of what he was able to do in October. And looking back, I don't think it's lost any of its luster. What he was able to do against the Dodgers, against Clayton Kershaw and Zach Greinke. And then moving on to the Cubs, I mean, he was the offense for that series. He was the whole thing. And even into the World Series, you know, things ended a little more sourly than Daniel Murphy would have liked, particularly with some of those defensive issues in the later games. But I think with the perspective of time, yeah, fans are able to look back and realize, hey, look, this isn't an all-time great Met, but he was a guy who kind of symbolizes where this franchise was and where it is now and what it's gotten to in a pretty short period of time here. I think fans are appreciative of that. I think they're appreciative of everything Daniel Murphy did for the club during his time here. And see, it wouldn't have been right if he had gotten booed.
Absolutely. So a nice turnaround after a tough weekend against the Rockies for the Mets. But when you look at this roster, the injury's starting to pile up a little bit. That's going to happen over the course of a baseball season. And the Mets have some good news about Steven Matz, that there's no structural damage there. But David Wright scratched with his back woes, again, acting up, I guess. I know it's always a thing with him, but he had a tough day yesterday. Duda also out, Flores on the DL, and that meant Matt Reynolds got promoted. Let's start with Wright, though. I know he just couldn't go, or Terry Collins told him he couldn't go. They don't want to risk anything further. But is this something that when it acts up like this, when the spinal stenosis kind of has a bad day, can it linger? Could he miss more games, or do you think he'll be back this series?
I think this is very much a feeling out period that neither side entirely knows. And, you know, I thought this is a really interesting case because this is the first time Terry Collins said where he wanted to play David Wright. This wasn't a scheduled day of rest. He was in there. He was supposed to play, and David Wright just couldn't go. And despite all of that, David Wright tried to get himself in the lineup. He tried to stay in the lineup. And this is exactly what he said he wouldn't do. This is exactly what the Mets said they would guard against, what David Wright said he couldn't do for himself, for his career. He couldn't push it if he knows he's on the edge physically, because you don't want to push it through one game and wind up missing 3 months. And that's what's happened to him in the past. So part of me thinks David Wright hasn't entirely learned his lesson here, that he needs to acquiesce a little bit more. But then on the other hand, he did wind up ultimately giving in. He sat out. And how much of that was David throwing his hands up and saying, okay, you win? And how much of it was Terry Collins saying, look, this isn't going to happen, you're sitting? I don't know. I think it was probably a little bit down the middle in between. But I think it's just a reminder, and maybe at a really good time for David Wright, and maybe at a really good time for the Mets, just a reminder that this thing isn't over. This is a condition that David Wright is going to deal with for the rest of his career, for the rest of his life. So he needs to be careful. The Mets have done everything they can to be careful with him, but at the end of the day, David Wright needs to be careful and honest and say what's on his mind, say what he's feeling, be open about it. And as long as he's doing that, I think there's a pretty good chance he's shown he can play through this thing, he can be productive through this thing. But if he's not doing that, then you're looking at a situation where he can get in trouble and he can get the Mets in trouble. So I think it's just a reminder, and probably a pretty well-timed reminder, as we're getting into the middle of the season now. We're getting into a time when guys are starting to get tired for the first time, and guys have played a lot, and so on and so forth, that he's just going to have to continue to be honest and open and hope that it's enough so that he's still standing and he's still out there in September.
This is Bill Latson of MLB.com. I'm here with Gio Gonzalez. Gio, thank you for being with me. Gio, you're off to a great start. I thought yesterday's game was really good. I think it was one of your best games. What did you think?
It means a lot coming from you, Bill. But as far as that, I mean, again, I can't take full credit for that. I mean, our bullpen has been A-plus, solid bullpen. They've helped us out in so many situations. You know, Felipe Rivero has been phenomenal. He's starting to have that veteran presence when he's on that mound. And Sammy Solis, you see what it is when he's healthy. And obviously, you can't complain with Sean Kelly. The guy's been great. Every time he grabs the ball, he's been phenomenal. So a lot of the credit goes to them. Lobie has been a workhorse back there every 5 days. And Willie, you know, we got such a great core of guys. I think that they have a game plan. And, you know, give your credit to the pitching coach too. He knows what he's doing. And obviously the skipper who's putting the pieces to play. So what's working is he knows the guys he wants to go with.
Mike Maddux, that's the guy you're talking about, the pitching coach. What has he done to make you consistent?
Just kind of like slow me down, help me pick up my target a little bit more. Just things that we worked on in the bullpen and continue from the bullpen to the actual game. I think that he's just nonstop, just giving me more information, more knowledge on how to approach a hitter, why not throw him this, why not do this, why not do that. I mean, I always give credit to a pitching coach, especially when you know, the results are coming out the way they are. So it's hard for me to say that I've done anything different. All I've done is pick up the target a little bit more. I've been the same pitcher, just a little bit longer in the zone now. So it's good to see where I'm focusing, I'm listening, I'm locked in, and I'm doing what I want to execute is go out there and pitch.
Gio, you've also talked to a guy who has helped you mentally. Could you talk about him?
Mark Campbell, absolutely. He's definitely a... He's helped out mentally to slow the game down in your own thought process, learn how to slow big situations down and just let stuff that had happened before, instead of letting it spiral out of control, just take a step back and refocus and get back in the strike zone. And, you know, he's been great with that. He's always kind of like giving me a fresh perspective in the thought process. We're giving me stuff that are positive to look at instead of, why is this happening and why is this happening, instead of just letting it go and on to the next one. You know, I think he has such a great idea, a great mindset of who the player you want to be. And I love his knowledge. Knowledge is always power.
You are not walking as many people as you have in the past.
Yeah.
Could you talk about why? Is it mechanics or is it just the mental approach?
It could be both. Well, I mean, it's also, like I said, it's something I've worked with Mike, helping me, you know, just stay longer in my zone, pick up the target a little bit more, and everything he says is always pitch with a purpose, have these pitches with a purpose. And, you know, every time I see Lobie's glove, there's a purpose I want to do. I want to execute that pitch, and that's where I've been. It's working on that in the bullpen, even when I'm throwing with Pap, with Jonathan Papelbon, it's been great. You know, he's helped me too on picking up little things where before it was just throwing the ball. Now it's actually, hey, stay close on this, pick it up, hit me in my chest. That little things go a long way. So I've been throwing with Pap a lot, so it's helped out too.
I'm glad you mentioned Jonathan Papelbon. He's a guy we really don't know, and it seems like you really like him a lot. What do you want us to know about him?
I think he's just a great teammate. You know, I think what he does, he has a lot of knowledge. He's fun to be around. He's got electric. He's always, he's fun in the clubhouse. And not only that, he's just a bookworm. Guy knows all his stuff. You know, he's been 10 all time. I mean, you got to give that guy all the credit in the world. You know, he's been doing it for so long. And what I love is that he wants to help you. He wants you to get better. He wants you to understand the game. And I'm glad that he had the time to do that with me in spring training, and he's doing it now throughout the season. Where he has a big heart, and he means well in everything he does. So for me, I think that Jonathan is a big piece to our bullpen, and you know we need him as healthy as a horse.
What has he done? What's the biggest thing he's done to help you?
He's just helped me kind of stay focused. You know, he's certain things that he looks at that he wants me to do. You know, instead of messing around, throwing while I'm warming up, there's actual things that he wants me to work on, and which is pretty cool. Where, you know, that's that maturity level and that discipline, that focus level where he doesn't let me kind of lose focus. And the same thing is vice versa. What he teaches me, I try to teach it back to him. So if he's just tossing it, he get back into the mode where I tell him to get in the chest. So that kind of relationship has been solid, you know, and I think the way he goes about his business, I mean, it's a good sign every time he goes out on the ninth inning. It means you're doing something right.
Gio, Dusty Baker said something after yesterday's game. He said Gio Gonzalez has become one of our best pitchers, and you've worked well under Dusty Baker. What does he mean to you?
I think Dusty's awesome. I think he's a fresh perspective in this year's 2016. You know, it's always sometimes you need to change the scenery. Mm-hmm. And obviously I'm trying to use it to my full advantage. Mm-hmm. And I think he's been a great great skip. You know, he's helped me out. He's given me words of wisdom, confidence. It's always nice to hear him. He takes his time and you know, he has a little couple words with me, and that goes a long way, especially as an athlete, knowing that that's a day-and-day basis where it's every day it's a grind to get to work and try to, you know, stay positive. So it's nice to see that. But I think Dusty complimented too much. I think that we have way too many solid pitchers. You know, Steven Strasburg, Tanner Roark has been great, you know, and Joe Ross and Max, you know, all these guys are true leaders in this rotation. You know, I'm definitely not going to take that away from them. They're the spotlight. I'm just trying to stay afloat with them.
Gio, what's ahead for you? Obviously you want to have a great year like you did in 2012. What's your goal?
Just stay healthy, Bo. I want to stay healthy. I want to continue to stay where I'm at, stay focused, and keep working hard. You know, I think that, you know, I haven't changed anything, bro. I've been the same guy. You know, track record's been the same. So I just want to be, like I said, healthy. I want to give every 5 days that chance to go out there and compete and give the team a chance to get a win.
Gio Gonzalez, thank you so much.
Absolutely, Bill. Thank you.
All right, as for those Phillies, they continue to win baseball games despite a frightening run differential, but they still 13-3 in the one-run games. The ERA is great in those games, if not overall. At what point is this, I don't want to say they're doing it with mirrors, but at some point something has to give, right? They either need to improve on that run differential or they're going to start losing some of these games eventually, right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I went back a couple weeks ago just out of curiosity, just to see how many postseason teams have actually finished the regular season with a negative run differential. And there's only been four. I think it was like there's a Diamondbacks team from in the 2000s, it was the Giants, I think, in 97, the 87 Twins, and the 84 Royals. And that is absolutely it. Now, what's interesting about those four teams is I think the worst one in that bunch had a negative run differential over a 162-game season of like 22, 23 runs. And the Phillies' negative run differential right now is much higher than that. So it's hard to – let me put it this way. If they would end up really contending, if it's late July and we're still talking about the Phillies being in the wild card race or, you know, could they be buyers, it would be – they would really be defying the odds because the numbers, like I said, just don't back up, you know, being outscored by this much, this often, and finishing the season with a winning record, much less making the postseason.
Yeah, and the 87 Twins won the World Series, so who
right.
knows, right? Well, they've started to make some moves, and I think trying to do something to spark that offense a little bit. They called up Tommy Joseph, and last week Marlon Anderson was filling in for you on the podcast, and he was actually against the move. It hadn't happened yet, but we discussed the possibility against the move because he didn't think Joseph would be getting enough playing time. But Joseph has been called up, got his first major league hit on Monday. What do you think about the decision to bring up a guy where they're obviously looking for a spark on that offense, and this guy was off to a great start at Lehigh Valley?
Yeah, I think that's what they're trying to do. I don't disagree with Marlon. I don't think he's going to get a lot of playing time to the point where if Tommy Joseph can hit like he hit in AAA, I just don't know if he's going to get enough at-bats because I just don't see them benching Ryan Howard right now for an unproven guy, you know. And listen, Tommy Joseph was the key prospect in the Hunter Pence trade in July of 2012. But he was taken off the 40-man roster last year. He was outrighted and really seemed like his career wasn't going to amount to much. So I don't think that the Phillies look at him as a saver, but I think they're just hoping like maybe they can strike while the iron is hot. And if he could maybe come up with a big hit here or there, either in a rare start or in a pinch hitting situation, that would help the offense. And that's what they need right now. They're so desperate for somebody to get a big base hit. And unfortunately for them, the starting pitching and the bullpen has been good enough, but they really do need offense. And maybe he can help him out a little bit, but yeah, I don't know if he's going to be looked at necessarily as a savior.
He certainly is a great story. You mentioned he actually cleared waivers. Nobody right. else was even interested in this guy, but he switched positions from catcher to first base, and he really has started to hit. Another guy who started to hit that maybe we were concerned about earlier in the season is Tyler Goodell, the Rule 5 guy from the Rays that you knew had to stay on this roster all year at the big league level if he was going to stick with the organization. And I think there was times when maybe there was questions about that, but he's heating up. 375 over his last seven games going into Tuesday, and he's driven in some runs in that time as well, and he even had a game-saving throw out of left field. What's been the difference for Goodell?
I think a lot of it is just getting the opportunity to play. One of the things that really kind of had me scratching my head the first month of the season was how little he was playing, and what confused me, I guess, a little bit is they weren't getting any production in left field or right field. If you look at the Phillies' OPS from their left fielders and right fielders, it's among the worst in baseball. So it's not a situation where this is a Rule 5 pick. We're going to get him a couple starts here or there, but we have such good talent and guys producing in left field and right field that we just don't have the time to play him or a means to play him. To me, the left field situation, the right field situation had been so bad. My opinion was, just throw the guy out there, you know, just throw him out there and let him play a little bit. You really have nothing to lose because you can't get much less production than you've already gotten. And now he seems to be getting in the lineup a little bit more, and he's kind of showing why the Phillies took him with that first pick in the Rule 5 draft. So, still early, still a small sample size, but nonetheless encouraging because, like we just started talking about earlier, they've got to start scoring some runs on a more consistent basis, and if Goodell can give them anything, it would be very, very welcomed.
So they get Goodell in the first pick of the Rule 5 draft, but in less than a month, the Phillies, Todd, have the first pick in the overall 2016 draft, and we're getting to that point where mock drafts are coming out and you're really starting to hear a lot of things. And there's certainly some interesting guys available. A.J. Puck, I think, is the guy a lot of people thought would be the obvious pick, but he struggled at times. There's some bats out there. And last night, Jason Groom, who's from South Jersey, he grew up a Phillies fan. He pitched in Camden, just across the river from Philadelphia, sold out ballpark and pitched great. He's a possibility, although you're not sure if the Phillies would want to go with a high school guy. Are you hearing anything about what way maybe the Phillies are leaning with that first overall pick? Because when you look at a rebuild, and certainly they've added a lot of talent to the organization, but they have to have this draft and that number one pick circled as a big part of this rebuild.
You know what? Yeah, they definitely – and I think last fall when I would talk to people in the organization, I think pretty much everybody thought they were definitely going to take a pitcher. I think at that time, like I said, late last fall, A.J. Puck seemed to be the guy that they were leaning towards. He pitched so well at the previous year for Florida. You know, he's got a ton of talent, obviously, but he hasn't been as good as I think maybe they had hoped this year. Doesn't mean anything right now. I mean, he could still become the number one overall pick, but I think everybody thought that they were going to draft the pitcher. Jason Groom, I think they love him, but if you look at the history of first overall picks, I don't know if a high school left-hander has been taken ever, and if it has, I think it might be just once. So looking at the history of it, do they take a shot on a high school left-hander? Remains to be seen. But I think right now there is a chance that they could take a position player. They have guys all over the country right now. There's a kid from Mercer, the outfielder from Mercer. There's a couple of high school kids from California that they're looking at, Blake Rutherford, Mickey Moniak. They like all of those guys. And what's interesting about this draft and kind of how the Phillies are handling it, and I'm sure a lot of every organization with the first overall pick handles it the same way, but it is really an all-hands-on-deck type of situation. So not only do they have all their amateur scouting guys, obviously, but you have people like former Phillies GM and president Pat Gillick out scouting these guys regularly. You have former Phillies manager Charlie Manuel scouting these guys regularly. You have a lot of the Phillies' top pro scouts giving these guys multiple looks. So the Phillies have all their bases covered when it comes time to make that selection. So I don't think they have settled on anybody. I think it's still very much up in the air with about a month to go. It would not surprise me if they took Groom or Puck, but it also would not surprise me if they took a position player because, hey, this season, if anything, is proving that you got to have somebody that can swing the bat a little bit and hit the ball out of the ballpark.
Joe, the Marlins continue to play very good baseball. Heading into Tuesday night, they've now won 3 in a row and on a bigger scale, 16 of 22. And they're suddenly right there in the East, 2 games back, although it seems like everybody in the East other than the Braves is right there, that division tightly contested right now. But I think the biggest lift we've seen from this team over the last week is that Jose Fernandez certainly looks like Jose Fernandez again. National League Pitcher of the Week, a couple of great starts overall, 11 Ks on Sunday. He even did it with a bat on Sunday. What's been the biggest difference between him over the last month or last, you know, 3-4 starts as opposed to maybe his first few starts when he still seemed a little rusty?
Okay, let's start with his last start, the win to get the 4-game split in Washington, which was really huge because the team, you know, the doubleheader on Saturday and, you know, having their starting pitcher, Kendry Flores, leaving after the third inning, you know, the bullpen had to pick up 6 innings in game 2 of a doubleheader. They played, 4 games in like a 45-hour span, so... You know, to me, when Jose went out through 7 innings and threw a career-high 117 pitches, struck out 11, as you noted, you know, he needed to kind of have a signature win on the road. You know, we all talk about his great home record, but on the road, you know, he's been beatable, you know, in his career, if you look at his track record. And to go into Washington, you know, in danger of losing 3 out of 4 there, and to really step up, you know, against the Nationals, who even had Bryce Harper take his 1-game suspension the night before, so Harper is in the lineup against Jose. You know, he really stepped up big. And I think, you know, there's a lot of what this team has wanted out of Jose Fernandez. We've talked in spring training about pitch and innings limits, you know, and about that 180. And we were talking in spring training, you might remember on podcast, about him trying to pitch more of his fastball and not just kind of using max effort and throwing so many breaking balls early and getting himself out of games. He really kind of pitched on Sunday. So if you're, you know, a long way around, but, you know, what's the difference, Jose, the last couple of starts is he's starting to pitch more than just be this, you know, power guy with a real nasty slider. Because if you look at some numbers, you know, some of the advanced numbers show teams aren't swinging the bat as frequently on Jose. They're basically willing to take 2-3 pitches before they even swing the bat. And the Nationals were doing that, and they had a chance to run his pitch count up real early. And Jose kind of still managed the game. And, you know, part of the way you do that is, you know, strike one. You know, you can't be down. You're down 1-0, 2-0, they're taking to the 4th, 5th pitch. So even if Jose pitches well, like he did early in the year when he was striking out 11-13, but out of the game after 5 or 6, you know, teams would get him out of the game and then trying to beat up the bullpen. So it's a combination of better fastball command and, you know, just kind of keeping himself under control and not getting so worked up to have to feel he has to strike everybody out. And as he's seeing, he's striking out guys just with effectiveness of pitches rather than trying to, you know, throw the nasty slider to make a guy look silly. You know, just let kind of the game come. But I think he's kind of maturing more as a pitcher we've seen in the last couple of outings.
Which is exactly what you want to see from an ace like him, that, you know, when they're young, they're throwing the flames and they get it done that way. But at some point, You have to mature as a starting pitcher, and we're seeing that before our eyes. There was a real scary moment over the weekend, Joe, as well. The collision right center field between Giancarlo Stanton and Marcell Ozuna, two guys this team cannot afford to be without.
Okay.
Luckily, they were both okay, and to the point that Stanton actually ends up homering in the game, and Ozuna just continues to rake over the last 16 games. He's got that 16-game hitting streak. Ozuna's a guy that obviously there's the high expectations, and maybe he took a little step back in 2015, which we see happen with players as they figure things out. But he is locked in right now, and he's not even feeling well right now, right? He's on the 16-game hitting streak, and is he battling a cold as well?
Yeah, you know, in Washington over the weekend, it rained a lot on top of all, you know, playing all those games in a short amount of time. Game one especially was just kind of played from innings like three on in a rainstorm, and he has a little bit of the sniffles and, you know, came out and hit a homer in the first game at Philly on Monday night. So, you know, he's battling a lot. Obviously, back to the collision, could have been catastrophic for this team. I mean, it seems whenever this team has things going well the last few years, something disastrous happens. And, you know, they could ill afford to be without Stanton or Ozuna. And here's the ball, like you say, in the gap. And Stan says he saw Ozuna coming. He thought he had a beat on it. He was calling him off. But Ozuna didn't hear him. And obviously, the center fielder can take charge as well. You know, fortunately, they clipped legs and didn't crash upper body. But they both took real hard falls. As you saw, Stanton kind of crashed his back and head area, neck into the wall. Ozuna's head, you know, smacked into the warning track. But, you know, they were down for a couple of seconds. The winner on it was Ryan Zimmerman, got an inside the park home run on the deal. But, you know, the Marlins were kind of winners that both stood up and both not only just stood up but stayed in the game and are just dealing with some, you know, typical soreness and bruises other than stuff that's keeping them out of the lineup. And who knows, maybe that's a good sign that maybe they could have a little bit of some physical stuff happen on the field without their key players going on the DL for extended time.
Yeah, they could use a little good luck in that area. Stanton's got the 11 home runs, which is great, and what you want from him. The average at this point, .233. Any concern about that, or is that just, I mean, to a degree, you don't need him to hit 300, but you'd like the average to be a little higher than .233.
Yeah, and I think that's a product of a streaky hitter. You know, he's kind of always been that. You know, if he could get up to 270, and you know, which he has hit at 268 to 280 type of range, obviously a force. With him, again, he gets so hot for a while, and then either teams pitch around him, or you know, he kind of, you know, loses the strike zone in terms of his strike zone discipline. And I never really worry about Stanton's numbers, Tim. I always worry about his health and just how he's feeling. You know, if he's okay, I think he's had a little something that we don't know about, you know, during this stretch. I see him talking to the trainer a lot, but he's still playing and he's shown no real ill effects of anything. He has a way of, when he's not hitting well, to not take BP on the field, to just go in the batting cage and work off a slider machine. So we don't know what he's doing in there. But I wouldn't be shocked if he had a little minor ailment that they've kind of kept under wraps from us. But obviously nothing to keep him out of the lineup. And you see he's even homering, so it's not like anything's really affecting him. To me, keep him on the field and the numbers will eventually be there. And I don't think he'll finish the year hitting in the 230s. I think he'll be hitting closer to 270 and north of that. And, you know, and it's key with Ozuna behind him because, you know, if there's production being, you know, spread over that lineup, he feels less pressure to do everything himself. So we saw what happened. They kind of got this hot streak going when he caught fire, started in the last game in San Francisco, went through L.A., and kind of continued, and he kind of helped them turn that season around. But they clearly need production from Stanton, and a little more consistency would be nice.
And, Mark, it's probably a day that we saw coming for quite some time, but as we record this podcast on Tuesday afternoon, Freddie Gonzalez has been relieved of his duties as manager. Bench coach Carlos Tosca has also been let go. AAA Gwinnett manager Brian Snitker is the new interim manager, and the pitching coach from Gwinnett also will have some work in the bullpen at the major league level. So, as I said, you kind of saw it coming that eventually this was going to happen. 9-28 while this team expected not to contend, they needed to see more wins than that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. You know, like you said, we've been waiting for this for a couple of weeks. Maybe we didn't expect it necessarily today. I certainly probably would have been surprised if it didn't happen by the end of the road trip, especially if the same trend would have continued through over the course of the remainder of this week. With that being said, I think that the team, when we started talking about this, to go with Brian Snicker, it makes a lot of sense. You know, our Eddie Perez and Terry Pendleton, the better candidates for a long-term job, sure. But I think the team essentially did Eddie and TP a favor by putting an interim manager in here, allowing them to move into different roles, especially TP, to become the bench coach. Eddie has had managerial experience in Venezuela. Being a bench coach will be the closest thing TP has done. That will enhance his resume, give the team a better sense of what he could provide if they would choose to name him their next manager. You know, at this point in time, it's way too early to speculate on who would be the permanent manager, but Eddie and TP, as things currently stand, I expect them, we'll be talking about them in the offseason when it comes time to name a manager for the 2017 season.
This is a team that when you look at from here on through the rest of the 2016 season, you would think we're going to see more and more players coming up from the minor league level. And how much does it help having the guy that was managing in Gwinnett now in Atlanta? Will that help ease the movement of players to the major league level?
You know what, in some ways, what I will say, for Snit is he's lost a lot of players already over the last few weeks. Came up here to Atlanta. There's a few more that could come up. You've got Lucas Sims and Tyrell Jenkins down there, John Gant, Rio Ruiz. But a lot of the guys that Brian Snicker had, that when you look at his roster, you think that's a pretty good roster. Well, they're up in Atlanta now. So, yes, it will help. You know what? Just having Brian Snicker here, this is a great baseball man, a guy who is going to be able to weather the storm. Who knows what transpires over the remainder of this season. They do have a rotation now that seemingly will keep them in ball games on a more consistent basis. They're able to look towards the future in that manner with the guys they have in that rotation now. We will eventually see a Dansby Swanson and Ozzie Albies probably up here. At that point in time, Brian Snicker was able to spend the last couple of weeks with Ozzie Albies. That helps. This team does not know exactly, how things are going to go win-loss-wise over the remainder of the season. And I think that, like I said, earlier, you hate to say, hey, this is being pinned on Brian Snicker, but I'm happy that Brian Snicker's going to be able to at least be a manager for a few months at the big league level. He deserves it. He's been in the Braves organization, the player, coach, manager since 1977. This is, one of the most influential men in the organization. If it's just a four-month stint at the big league level, hey, I hope he enjoys every bit of it. At the same time, I don't think the club wanted to saddle TP or Eddie and hurt their candidacy for future manager jobs just based on when teams, whether it's the Braves or other teams, look at say, well, look what they did when they were given that job. So they'll be put in leadership positions. Brian Snicker is a great communicator. Everyone, the players, the coaches, everyone will respect him. And I fully expect that they'll all enjoy playing and working with him. So it's going to be interesting. Freddie Gonzalez was a good guy to work with as well, for many of the coaches. The players, there were some issues there where some players questioned some leadership issues. They wanted him to be a little bit more authoritative in different situations. This is either the fact that the Braves are 9-28 is not all on Freddie Gonzalez, but at the same time, once you reach this point, you do, from a public perception, you do have to make a change. And I think it's pretty safe to say the Braves knew that even when things got better, when the talent, the raw talent on this roster improves, they did not want Freddie as their manager.
Freddie overall proved earlier in his stint with the Braves that he could win at Atlanta. Obviously, he won a division title. His first 4 years, they never finished worse than second, although one of those years they did have a losing record. Overall, 434 and 413 as Braves skipper. You mentioned that it's too early to kind of look to next year and who's going to be the full-time replacement eventually for Freddie Gonzalez. But do you have any thoughts on the kind of manager that the Braves are going to be looking for, considering they're in the middle of this youth movement and there's going to be a lot of teaching to be done?
Yeah, you know what, Neil? You know, I know better in this business. It's never too early to discuss it. I shouldn't have, I guess what I should have said is it's too early to accurately know exactly who they're going to target. TP and Eddie will be the internal guys that they'll look at. You know, we've heard a lot about Bud Black. You know, that he has a relationship with John Hart, dates back many years, John Schuerholz. Those are guys that have been mentioned. I went back, you know, you go back to last October when we first started talking about this, when I first started writing, and I mentioned Mark DeRosa. I still think he's in the mix. I think he's the guy that they're interested in. And the question will be, does Mark DeRosa want to give up his responsibilities there at the network? I think he's got a wife in Atlanta and some kids that would like for him to be home on a more consistent basis. But we'll see when that time comes. I think that they're going to be looking for, obviously, a guy that can relate well to young players. And I think that's what's going to give. They're going to evaluate TP and Eddie as to how they relate to these players as they bring them up this year.